You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. From the studios of WFHB Community Radio, this is Cade Young.
And reporting remotely, I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB Local News for Friday, May 8th, 2020.
Later in the program, WFHB correspondent Katrine Bruner discusses the impact that this pandemic has had on the local music community with MCCSC Orchestra Director John Hansen.
Also coming up in the next half hour, WFHB News Director Cade Young covers the Sean Reed shooting as the Indianapolis police face growing questions after killing three people in the matter of 8 hours. That's all coming up later in the program. But first, your local headlines. Bloomington City Council member Jim Sims presented a resolution denouncing and condemning white nationalism and white supremacy during their May 6th meeting.
The city of Bloomington denounces and condemns hate based on racial, social, and cultural bias and holds up values of peace, respect, inclusivity, and equity. The city is committed to continue pursuing policies and directing appropriate resources to ensure civil and human rights are protected and afforded to all individuals.
Sims referred to historical racist events in the resolution. He said the resolution has to become a living document.
We now have an official resolution that sets an official city position that is supported by city government and the will of this community. I want to caution folks that this is not a comprehensive catalog of all the social ills in which we discuss and deal with in this community. It is, however, hoped to inspire thought, community conversation, and actions that will support the fair and equitable treatment of our fellow humans. I also think that this will galvanize that this is the right thing to do regarding our fellow humans and humanity on the whole.
Councilmember Kate Rosenbarger said some city policies perpetuate systematic racism, such as single-family zoning. She read a quote from The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein.
He's the leading scholar on this topic, and his book forces us to face the obligation to remedy our past. So he says, to prevent lower-income African-Americans from living in neighborhoods where middle-class whites resided, local and federal officials began in the 1910s to promote zoning ordinances to reserve middle-class neighborhoods for single-family homes that lower-income families of all races could not afford. Certainly, an important and perhaps primary motivation of zoning rules that kept apartment buildings out of single-family neighborhoods was a social class elitism that was not itself racially biased. But there was also enough open racial intent behind exclusionary zoning that it is integral to the story of de jure segregation.
Rosenbarger said righting wrong is not always easy. Councilmember Matt Flaherty says the country has deep roots in racism.
Persistent systems of racism, discrimination, and exclusion exist in our current housing policies, land use policies, transportation policies, in our criminal justice system, our educational system, and our public health system, and more. And I want to highlight these issues specifically because I think for too many of us, it is easy to lose sight of these underlying systems of oppression. When the overt discrimination of avowed white supremacists is not front and center, it can be too easy for those who are not in the marginalized group to forget that we still live with systemic and structural racism and discrimination all around us. And these issues are present in Bloomington today, and it's part of our job to dismantle these systems and to do our research and to learn and understand how particular criminal justice or housing or transportation policies perpetuate racial and other disparities in our city.
Councilmember Stephen Volan proposed an amendment to the resolution to add Wan Jun Yoon's name to the whereas clause that refers to the story of his murder. Council members unanimously passed the resolution as amended.
Up next, Alex Dieterer delivers two headlines from home. First up, she talks about how Bloomington Herald-Times editor Rich Jackson was laid off. Then she covers a protester cited at the city's farmers market who is now suing the city. For more, we turn to Alex Dieterer.
Rich Jackson, senior executive editor of the Herald Times, was laid off by Gannett, the newspaper's owner, on April 24th. Top editor of the Herald Times for 10 months, Jackson took to Facebook and posted he also had to vacate his apartment in the Herald Times building on South Walnut Street by May 1st. The apartment was offered to Jackson for a time, rent-free, by the newspaper. Jackson started a blog about his experience and shared that he is now homeless. His first four posts received 20,000 page views. On April 29th, he stated via his blog, The Homeless Editor, quote, "I've saved a little money after many struggles, decades in the making, but I need to make those savings last as long as possible as a 54-year-old man seeks a new job in what the Federal Reserve calls the worst economy in American history. That's when I decided to blog this story. For years, I have written or edited hundreds of stories about homelessness, and here I am." End quote. Jackson now finds himself finding shelter at a Motel 6 after signing a non-disparagement agreement as part of his departure from the Herald Times. In an interview with Indianapolis Monthly, Jackson stated, quote, "My story is unique. You don't often hear of executive editors becoming homeless, but it's also not in that we live in an economy that can change quickly. I was hoping to convey that if it's happening to me, it can happen to a lot of folks." End quote. Thomas Westgaard was cited last November for disorderly conduct at the Bloomington Farmers Market and is now suing the city. Westgaard was one of five protesters cited last year while they protested the presence of Schooner Creek Farm, co-owned by Sarah Dye, who proclaims to be an identitarian, at the market. In the suit, Westgaard claimed he was cited for violating, quote, "unofficial and undisclosed," end quote, rules of protesting at the market. In the seven-page tort notice, Westgaard claims the group of protesters he was with were selectively targeted by the Bloomington police. Westgaard is seeking $500,000 in damages.
City of Bloomington Utilities began demolition on the Griffey Lake Water Treatment Plant located on North Dunn Street. The site was found to have mercury contamination in 2017, as well as asbestos and PCB contamination. According to a city press release, substantial demolition is projected within 90 days. All hazardous material is being shipped to the appropriate hazardous waste facilities. The city plans to reserve features of the building's entry to create a monument for the plant's role in Bloomington's history. The press release states, after demolition, the site will be restored to a natural meadow.
Now WFHB Assistant News Director Sydney Foreman breaks down the latest Monroe County Commissioners meeting.
The Monroe County Commissioners approved a tax abatement for an Ernest Health structure. County Attorney Jeff Cockerell said property is located within the State Road 36 Corridor Tax Increment Finance District. Senior Vice President of Marketing and Development for Ernest Health, Angie Anderson, said the facility is a rehabilitation middle ground between a hospital and home.
So inpatient rehab is licensed as a hospital, but patients come to us after they've been typically in the hospital. They don't have to be in a hospital, but they have a medical necessity that they just aren't able to go home. So I heard somebody refer to it as a post-surgical. That's common, but it could be from stroke, brain injury, spinal cord injury. It could be a bilateral joint replacement. Anything that compromises someone medically and also physically, that there's no way they could go back to their home and be able to do the things to, you know, be safe at home. So that's what the hospital is for.
Anderson said the hospital will be called Bloomington Regional Rehabilitation Hospital, but an Ernest Health logo will be on the building. She said Ernest Health ranked in the top 10% of U.S. rehabilitation facilities. Anderson said Indiana University Health chose Ernest Health to replace their rehabilitation center.
We were part of an RFP, the process from IU. They requested proposals because they knew in their replacement hospital that they weren't going to make room for that inpatient rehab unit that's currently there. So they wanted to make sure that that service was still provided in the community. And so they reached out to various providers to make this proposal back to them. And we were selected through that process.
Anderson said the hospital would bring 40 private inpatient rooms and 110 jobs phased in over 3 years. She said rooms are full of natural light and spacious. Anderson explained how economic dollars would be kept in the community.
Bringing this caliber of a service to the Bloomington area so that they don't have to leave and go to Indianapolis or travel south. Those economic dollars stay in the community, because if a family member is driving back and forth to Indy to visit their loved one in the inpatient rehab hospital, they're also shopping there, having lunch there, having dinner there, buying gas there, you know, all the things, all those dollars leave your county. We are creating high-paying jobs. We will contribute back to in the form of taxes, even though we're asking for tax abatement. You know, we're in for the long haul in this community.
Anderson said current IU Health employees would fill some job positions. She said an independent van would assist with patient transportation from hospitals. Commissioner Julie Thomas said the site plan allows for a small bus access point. Now it's time for your feature reports. Up first, WFHB News Director Cade Young covers the Sean Reed shooting as the Indianapolis police faced growing questions after killing three people in the matter of 8 hours.
A 21-year-old black man was killed by police in Indianapolis on Wednesday. The victim's family and friends identified the man as Drajon Reed, who was commonly known as Sean. Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department faces growing questions after killing three people in the matter of 8 hours. The deaths included two shootings and an officer who struck and killed a woman with his vehicle. According to a police report, Sean Reed was spotted for, quote, driving recklessly in a gray Toyota Corolla at approximately 6 p.m. Deputy Chief for IMPD Kendall Adams and Police Chief Randall Taylor began pursuing the driver in separate unmarked vehicles. Adams and Taylor removed themselves as marked cars arrived in the pursuit, as is standard procedure, said the police report. At around 6:10 p.m., the pursuit was terminated by the sergeant who was monitoring the pursuit. Officers allegedly backed away from the vehicle and disengaged emergency equipment. The police report said just before 6:16 p.m., a Northwest Indianapolis district officer observed the gray Toyota Corolla pull into the rear of a business. The report said a short foot pursuit occurred eastbound from the location. Then, after the victim reportedly ignored commands to stop, the officer deployed a taser. According to the report, quote, it appears the taser was ineffective and an exchange of gunfire between the driver and the officer followed. The driver was struck by the gunfire, end quote. Sean Reed was pronounced dead at the scene. The police chase was streamed live on Facebook by Reed. After Reed was tased, his phone falls to the ground. Reed is no longer visible. At least 13 gunshots can be heard. After the victim is fatally shot, officers are heard laughing. One officer is heard saying, quote, it looks like it's going to be a closed casket, end quote. You are about to hear the audio from the end of the Facebook stream. We warn you, the listener, that the following content is graphic. The audio is taken from Now This.
Yep. I saw this. I'll probably back. I got it. Looks like it's going to be a closed casket, homie.
When did he tase him?
He probably run right after here. Him and then tase him. And then
I'm saying that's a good tase. Shoot at him.
Sean Reed's sister, Jasmine Reed, commented on the shooting of her brother to WTHR.
Yes, he decided for whatever reason he wanted to do a high speed.
Yeah, but he didn't think that he was going to kill him.
He didn't think, you know, he's 21 and young, he looked dumb. So he don't always think before he do certain things. They could have tased my brother, beat him up. He could have been behind bars. But now I got to look at him. He's going to be in the casket the next time I see him.
Almost 200 Indianapolis residents gathered in Monument Circle on Thursday to mourn the death of Sean Reed in a prayer vigil and protest. Vehicles blocked the intersection of West 62nd Street and Michigan Road, where the shooting took place the night before. Many protesters wore face masks. Some protesters stayed in their vehicles, hanging out of their windows and sunroofs as they remembered Sean Reed. Protesters chanted and shouted in demonstration against overuse of police power.
Come on!
Randall Taylor, chief of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, gave a press conference about the three recent deaths by IMPD officers.
Our city had a tragic, challenging evening last night. There were three separate incidents involving IMPD officers that ended in tragedy. I want to speak this morning as each one of them. Before I begin, however, I want to be clear that each of these incidents will be investigated thoroughly through standard department procedures.
Deputy Chief Chris Bailey said a loaded gun was found near the victim.
A loaded gun was found and recovered belonging to the deceased person. Additionally, ballistic evidence recovered from the scene initially indicates that shots were fired from both the officer's weapon and the decedent's weapon. This will all be confirmed as evidence is tested by the Marion County Forensic Services Agency. The IMPD Critical Incident Response Team is handling the criminal investigation, and the Marion County Prosecutor's Office was on the scene as well. Once the criminal investigation is complete, it will be handed off to the Marion County Prosecutor's Office for their review. An internal affairs investigation is also ongoing, and the incident will undergo several other administrative reviews. As the officer is currently marked off on administrative leave, as a standard procedure in these type of incidents.
After online speculation that the gun was not Reed's, IMPD Chief Taylor said it's reasonable to believe it was the victim's weapon. Taylor addressed the online speculation.
While we continue to process the scene, I believe it's reasonable to believe that this gun was the individual's. It is a distinct-looking gun with an orange slide and elongated grip. We are aware of photos showing the driver holding a similar distinct-looking weapon, distinct-looking gun on social media sites. We recovered 15 shell casings from two guns, and the magazines of both guns show bullets had been fired. It appears the gun found near the individual was fired at least twice.
Furthermore, Taylor addressed the inappropriate comments made by a detective following the shooting.
We're also aware of inappropriate comments made by an IMPD detective that was broadcast live on social media during the incident. This comment was made by a detective who was not present at the time of the shooting, but responded to the scene following the shooting. Let me be clear, these comments are unacceptable and unbecoming of our police department. We will be pursuing immediate disciplinary action against that officer. We're also aware of social media speculation around the identity of the officer who made the comments. While that information will be handled through our standard disciplinary process, we can confirm that the detective you see turning off the live video did not make the comment.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Indiana called for a transparent and independent investigation in the wake of the fatal police shooting. ACLU of Indiana said in a statement, quote, "We join many in the community by calling for a prompt, thorough, and transparent investigation into the deadly shooting of Drayshon Reed. The public deserves to get a detailed account of why this man was shot and what actions Indianapolis police took to avoid yet another fatal shooting," end quote. ACLU also said, quote, "We see time and time again that excessive force by police disproportionately impacts Black and Brown community members. Law enforcement in Indiana should treat all communities with dignity, employ restraint on police power, and use only the degree of force necessary to maintain the community's safety," end quote. The victim's father, Jamie Reed, told the Indy Star that he was crushed by the things he saw and heard. He said, quote, "It just shows me that we're really not being protected and served. We're being hunted. My son was a great son. I love him to death. He was just a typical young adult like anybody else. He didn't deserve to die like that." For WFHB News, I'm Cade Young. Now in the program, WFHB correspondent Katrine Bruner discusses the impact that this pandemic has had on the local community with MCCSC Orchestra Director John Hansen. This is part one of Voices from the Music Community of Bloomington.
When Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb ordered the closure of all schools with immediate transfer to online schooling for the remainder of the year, it took a lot of adjustment both for teachers and students. Teachers had to promptly set up a new system of teaching their students online, whether it be through videos, recorded PowerPoints, or simple online assignments. students were forced to adapt to a new setting, learning through a screen. This could easily cause more issues for students from lack of connection with their peers and teachers, distractions at home, and the shock of a new territory to embrace. Although many subjects can be easily transferred to online lessons, classes such as choir, band, and orchestra don't work as well in this setting. Students who depend on their contact with music teachers or playing in school are finding it difficult to adapt to the closure of schools from the coronavirus. Most of all are the dependency of these classes that many students have taken to as almost a home. Students who rely on their music classes to get them through the day are taking the hardest hits right now and could easily be neglected and feel that the rest of their schoolwork is unattainable without that outlet. Director of all MCCSC orchestras, John Hansen, expressed his feelings on teaching music to hundreds of students online. Hansen has been teaching in Bloomington for 4 years now, where he teaches Tri-North and Jackson Creek Middle Schools, as well as South and North High School. He also conducts the Hoosier Youth Philharmonic, which is the South and North High Schools combined. Hansen has had the help from the beginning from assistant director and teacher Julie Enzinger, who has been working with MCCSC orchestras since before Hansen took the job, after previous director of 40 years, Jane Gauker, retired. At the beginning of the adjustment to online lessons, Hansen admitted that he felt it difficult to adjust to, and also explained what it felt like to lose the connection that he usually had with his students in a classroom setting.
When I started off teaching remotely, I felt handicapped. I felt that, you know, I think a good deal of what makes orchestra a great experience for kids, why kids like orchestra, I think, is the community. And especially with Hoosier Youth Philharmonic and the orchestras at South and North, we definitely feel like a family. And so for me to not have that daily connection, even just, you know, the regular as banter between teacher and students, but not having that sort of connection with the students felt very strange to me. And like I said, I felt a bit handicapped by the remoteness of it.
Hansen explained that as an orchestra class, online assignments were not a vital part of class time.
Yeah, the orchestras are performing ensembles, and we have a really busy concert schedule. Oftentimes, we're just working to the next concert. We're preparing that music as performers. So the idea of me giving a lot of assignment of music theory or whatnot is a little bit not realistic, considering how much we perform and the emphasis of the class being performance. So it was getting used to Canvas on my part was quite a struggle. I think the students may have been very used to it just from their academic class.
Currently, Hansen said that he has been connecting with students every day over Canvas. He also said that the online setting has given him a chance to hear from many students that he wouldn't get to spend as much time hearing in class.
I found early on, as I was writing a lot of verbiage to kids about, okay, you know, in measure 17, your F natural needs to be a low 2. I was doing that at first, and then I found it was a lot easier just for me to pick up my violin or a viola and play it for them, you know, to talk to them and play it. So, and I'll tell you, there are some silver linings of this. And one thing I found, which I really like, is I'm having a connection and I'm getting to give practical advice and tiny, tiny little lessons, keeping in mind that, you know, there's a couple of hundred students, right? I'm getting to connect with that last chair player, which I really love. In our rehearsals, I'm so conscious of the students who sit closer to me, obviously, right? I'm hearing them, and I don't get to hear exactly how last chair second violin is playing their note. And so through these Canvas assignments of them learning a piece kind of bit by bit, I've gotten to actually hear that last chair player and to connect with them and give them some advice of things to fix. And I would say I'm also pleasantly surprised some of those last chair players are getting those notes great.
The opportunities and expectations that the high school orchestra classes have lost these past months has been one of the hardest things for students and their teachers, Hansen said. The HYP was expected to go to Nashville, Tennessee at the end of March. However, because of the virus, it was canceled.
We were set to go to Nashville, Tennessee and perform, and everybody was excited. We were excited to go to Nashville and all of the things that that would entail, but also just to represent Bloomington. We knew we were going to play well and done well in these competitions in the past, and we were really hoping to come away from there with a big trophy and do something great for Bloomington. And so that was the first really difficult thing for the students and for me and Ms. Enzinger.
Hansen also explained that it took a lot of preparation and hard work to get to the point that they were at right before the trip got canceled.
So we were getting to the point 10 days out or whatever it was where we were just excited to go. And that's the best part when you've done all the work and the preparation and the planning and, you know, the fundraisers and collecting the money and all of that. Then you just get to get on that bus and go and perform and do your best. And that's the really exciting part. That's the fulfilling part for me as a director and I think for the students too.
For graduating seniors, Hansen expressed his disappointment for those students who have lost so much in a matter of months.
It's the word that might be a little bit hackneyed and people use a lot, but it's so apt, is it's unprecedented. In my 30 years, I've not had something like this ever happen. And I feel the most regret for what the seniors are going through. And so we're also trying to do something in Hoosier Youth Philharmonic for our seniors too, just a little tribute. And I hope that all of those things add up for the students and they can, you know, get some sort of meaningful sort of end to their high school years and not feel too robbed by this whole situation.
In terms of what the plans are for the next school year, Hansen said that he, along with many teachers, wonders what classes will be like. He said that for kids in music classes, the idea of no contact is hard to imagine.
Yeah, thinking of next year, that's another thing that's very much on my mind. What will it be like in August? And will we be allowed in the buildings, or will it still be distance learning? We don't know these things yet. If we're allowed in the buildings, how the heck does orchestra function, right? You know, you have to think about a group like orchestra or band or even football, right? These things depend on this very close contact. We have to tune the instruments. Our rooms are filled to capacity at the moment. And so the idea of socially distancing by 6 or 10 feet in an orchestra, I'm not sure exactly how that would happen, but we have thought it through and we're continuing to. And orchestra will go on and school will go on. It's just we're not exactly, nobody is sure how that's going to look at the moment.
Finally, Hansen expressed his feelings for the students and not being able to see them for so long, and how important that everyday connection has been to him as a music teacher and a person in general.
That connection with young people is something that really kind of makes my life, right? It fills out my life. And I feel on a normal day, when everything's normal, I feel like I have more sort of love and just sort of joy in my life than the average person. But missing the students is terrible, and not being able to see them every day. And I know that we're going to get past this, but it's just a question of how long. And in the meantime, the other day I got to play Happy Birthday for a student who turned 15, and that was exciting. So yeah, that's the thing, just how much we miss the students.
For WFHB, I'm Katrine Bruner.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Alex Dieterer, Cade Young, and Sydney Foreman in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our features were produced by Cade Young and Katrine Bruner.
Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Our executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
And I'm Cade Young. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent local news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for KiteLine, a program amplifying the voices of those within Indiana's prison system, coming up next on WFHB.